Broadcasting live from South Texas, this is your Petardcast. I am your host, Mr. Leonard Pierce, and though I am in the depths of a heinous and undetermined sickness, I can assure you that it won't interfere with the completion of this episode. It will just make it a lot less funny. For our 12th episode, we will be joined by Scott Vondoviak, a fellow Texan and member in proud standing of the Hollywood Star Whackers. We'll also be dipping back into news from the stars with New Celebrities Are Our Betters, giving our titbits a fresh injection of comedic collagen, and delivering some baseball humor, which everybody loves. All that in my normal lispy annoying voice racked with savage coughing. What could be more tempting to your inner ear than this week's Petardcast? That was Hayden Childs with a new Guided by Voices remix of the Petardcast theme song. Hayden is our master of musical miniatures here at the Petardcast, and we're always grateful for his adventurous sense of boredom that leads him to record stuff like that. We're going to dip in for our first segment to another installment of my legendary New York Times column from the late 1980s entitled Tidbits. You may recall that I wrote for the New York Times for a period in the late 1980s, giving advice to American men about how to be properly masculine until the column was discontinued for being a figment of my imagination. This piece was written in 1987 in response to a request from Americans for staunch manliness. They were concerned at the time that the heterosexual ideal was being lost, and I told them that I'd do my part to pitch in and bring it back, and I think we can all agree that I succeeded. Good news, ladies. Men are back. Or rather, men are back. And not just men, either, but real men. Men who know exactly what you want and stand unafraid of giving it to you in precisely the quantities they know you need. Men of old, men of renown, who perspire freely. Land grabbers, warmongers, men who want nothing more than to work on their motorcycles all day while not wearing shirts. Men who don't know how to cook and don't want to know. Men who wouldn't even if they could. Truth be known, these men don't even want to eat. They just want to drink beer. Men are back. Surly morons who all look the same and play pool all night. Men whose fetching come heather scent is bewitchingly reminiscent of Bambi's soft and tenders. Men who don't loaf around the library all day. The men you've been pining for have finally returned. But there are changes. Perhaps not changes, really. Merely new angles, new facets and facades of men that you may have never seen except in this bright new masculine light. For example, would you ever have thought that a real man would wear pinstripes and a tie? But there he is. Real men know that there's power in America that goes beyond the bicep. A man isn't really a man unless he's doing the deal, making wheels turn. The man who's real knows, just as he knows that women desire him, that money is where it's at. The man remembers how to push people around, and that includes you too, gals. But don't worry, even though he's greasing the gears of capital, he's still the rugged behemoth you want to fawn over. All you have to do is take off his very expensive shirt, and there's the broad, hairless chest you've been waiting for. And always in evidence is the perfectly styled hair with that one lock just slightly out of place as if it had fallen there by accident. And always there is that casually cruel expression that tells you exactly what you want to hear. I couldn't care less about you. You are my plaything. I have chosen you to amuse me. But there's still plenty of surprises in store. Is your real man embarrassed to be seen cavorting barefoot on a beach with a gigantic earth ball? No, he is not. Because, of course, any opportunity to appear shirtless. Does our real man pale at the prospect of wearing spectacles? No, he does not. Because despite the presence of sissified glasses, he knows that you figured out they're fake. And besides, he's still got the hair and the chest and the look and the cold blue eyes. Contacts under glasses. Our man is a man of many levels. And that cowcatcher chin. And he can always take the damn cheaters off. Your man looks sexy in jeans again. Your man is surly, a Brando-esque wife-beater lurking beneath each cologne ad. Your man is wealthy again, goony football stud improbably driving a Lexus. Women everywhere knowing what a big cock he must have to drive such an expensive yet safe automobile. Your man is dumb again, the meager thoughts behind that sweat-sexy forehead never straying far from the subject of his next shot, his next lay, his next beer. Your man finally has his priorities straight, wasting no time being sick or going to school or trying to understand someone as different as his woman. He knows what's important in making himself and you happy in your little world, no matter what it happens to cost you. Your man is finally yours. Every finely sculpted, silent, starkly photographed, low-angle, dramatically lit, flash-frozen pixel of him. And he's yours at a cost well within our means. Good news, ladies. Men are back. Buy now, while supplies last. All right, joining me for this dozenth edition of the Petardcast is a very special guest, Mr. Scott Vondoviak. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing good, Leonard. Let's get petarded in here.
All right. Please identify yourself to our theoretical audience. Tell them who you are and what you do.
Well, I believe you have announced me as Scott Vondoviak, which I am, and I live in Austin, Texas, and I'm a writer-type person. I started in the very lucrative field of independent film, and did some writing and acting there, and when, for some reason, my anticipated millions did not come my way, I sort of switched more to writing about film and pop culture, which I do for several very fine media outlets, the AV Club, Nerve, the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, primarily those, and also I wrote me a book. It's called Hick Flicks, The Rise and Fall of Redneck Cinema.
And where could one purchase that book if one were so inclined?
Well, it's from McFarland Publishers. You can get it from their site, or you can get it from your Amazon or Barnes & Noble online sites. And probably not at a bookstore unless it's extremely specialized.
Well, it's hard to believe you didn't make it in the indie film world. I mean, that's usually a formula for getting rich quick.
It really is. I was shocked. I looked at Kevin Smith and said, "This guy can do this."
But, I could be as fat as that guy someday.
I tried for a while, but I don't know. It was he's got a special drive I just don't have, I guess. But so yeah, I lived for 5 years out in the Los Angeles area. But strange enough, all of the films that I actually ended up working on had nothing to do with living out there. I did them in Boston and in Austin. So living in L.A. was also not a recipe for success.
Again, hard to believe. It seems like everybody who goes out there makes it, right?
That's what I always heard. You know, I went to film school and spent a lot of money on that, and they kept stressing the point that when it was over, I would go out to L.A. and make my fortune, and yet it's not happened.
Crazy. Well, you live in Austin now.
I do.
What do you have to say about that?
Well, in Austin, Texas, we tend to have a superiority complex. We think that we're the only good part of Texas, so we look down on Dallas and Houston and where you are in San Antonio, and we're very smug about that. But other than that, coming up next week, or perhaps already as your listeners hear this, will be something called South by Southwest, which your listeners may be familiar with.
That's the annual gathering where people get together to complain that it's not as good as it used to be.
That is it. But, you know, that's basically the number one pastime in Austin anyway. Depending on when you got here, you will have heard that it was at its best immediately before you arrived. And I learned this when I moved here, and one of the first people I talked to in a coffee shop or something mentioned to me that he had moved here in, like, 1972, and as soon as he got here, people were telling him, you just missed it, man. So, but South by Southwest, also there's a large contingent of Austinites who hate it or disparage it. They complain about it. They complain that there are people here from out of town. There's too much traffic. There's no parking. All of this is true, but, it is a week-long citywide block party, basically, and there's a million free things to do, and there's free music and free booze all over the place, so...
I
think those people should just, if you don't like South by Southwest, I feel like you don't like fun, and if you don't like fun, you should just move to Dallas or one of the other Texas...
or San Antonio. There's nothing fun down here.
There's the Alamo.
That is fun for the 5 minutes it takes to see it. You have developed over the years something of a reputation as you like to put it, Film Criticism's official movie janitor. You sort of specialize in watching films and discussing films that are, to put it mildly, shitty.
Well, yeah. That was sort of almost thrust upon me. I was many years a film critic for the Star-Telegram. I still write for the Star-Telegram, but I was basically, for a long time, I was sort of on the movie janitor beat. Like, there was the main film critic, and then there was some other people, and then there were the movies that none of them would touch with a 10-foot pole, so I would get the email every week and say, you're going out to see the NSYNC movie.
Or Catwoman.
Catwoman or the like. So then, I don't know, I somehow, after seeing so many terrible movies, I sort of got brainwashed into thinking it was a good idea to watch them, and I started a project called Unwatchable, where my plan was to watch the 100 worst movies of all time as ranked on the IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, where you can rank your favorites, but you can also rank your least favorites. And I'm about three-quarters of the way through. I've kind of stalled out a little bit. It's rough. It's rough going.
Would you say that you've learned anything from all these years of watching incredibly shitty movies?
Well, I learned that I probably would have been better served watching better movies. People may think that all crappy movies are crappy in different ways, and that would make them interesting, and to some extent that's true, but I don't know. A lot of crappy movies are crappy in the exact same way, especially nowadays. So
they're kind of like families in a Tolstoyan sense, except instead of all happy families being happy in the same way, all shitty movies are shitty in the same way.
Yeah, I would say that shitty movies have gotten worse. Shitty movies used to have personality, and now they're just, they spend $150, $200 million to make a shitty movie, which just is, it's just against the whole principle of the thing, I think.
All right, fair enough. Well, are you ready to have a dialogue?
I am ready.
All right, let's go. I want him on the hill tomorrow, Barry.
John, I know you like the kid.
Like him, hell, he's got a 2.81 ERA. Fuck if I like him, he's got the goods.
He's clubhouse poison.
Yeah, you've been reading the papers again.
All due respect, John, I see him in there every goddamn day. All you see is the box score.
That's all I need to see. I don't give a shit what the columnists print. He could be Saddam fucking Hussein, as long as he's winning ball games.
He ain't gonna be winning them for long, John. Guys like this, they burn themselves out.
That's not what the scouts say. Lefty, sidewinder, he could go for 10 years.
You know what I mean. It's the arguments with the umpires.
So he's hot-headed. I like a kid with a little fire.
Did you hear what he said to Colbert the other day when he got tossed?
I know he was arguing balls and strikes, and I know you can't do that, but he's young. He'll learn.
He wasn't arguing balls and strikes. He was arguing against the whole notion of balls and strikes. He said they were arbitrarily created delineations that, while useful in the practical sense of moving play ahead, were often enforced unscientifically, according to judgments that had more to do with the realm of aesthetics than they did with game theoristic arbitrage. And he said if you were going to call the game purely from an artistic standpoint, he didn't see how a knuckleball, which embodies theory and structure, could be construed as inferior to the brute praxis of a hitter, no matter how far away from the plate it was.
College boys, what are you gonna do?
He also suggested that in the absence of a mechanical device that measured pitches accurately, his own interpretation of strike was no less valid than anyone else's, and that Merriweather's master narrative devalorized his own, thus negating all the hard work he'd put in to get to the show.
Well, Merriweather is kind of fat, Barry. You have to admit that.
And this stuff goes on every day, John. If I hear one more word about Donna Haraway in the locker room, I'm going to scream.
Who was that, his agent?
I think she's a robot or something. It's all robots and privileging with that guy.
Fans like him.
That's because they don't have to listen to him every day.
Press is crazy about him.
That's because they like a guy who says a bunch of horseshit every time he opens his mouth. The press was crazy about Dennis Rodman. The press was crazy about Mike Tyson.
He's got a 2.81 ERA, Barry.
Christ, John, don't do this to me. I have enough guys yelling at me because I told them no big screen TV in the clubhouse when we're under 500. Some of the other pitchers hide in the bathroom when they see he's finished his warm-ups.
You want to stay above 500, you don't bench one of your best pitchers because he's kind of a head case.
He threw a beanball at Scott Rolen last week because he heard that Rolen liked Alfea, John. Something has to be done.
Well, maybe I gotta make a way to make this work for us. Who we got next week?
Pittsburgh, then Atlanta.
Okay, here's the deal. We sit him for Pittsburgh, then we keep him away from the press, maybe float a trade rumor.
Yeah?
Then we tell him that Maddox said that the Paris post-structuralists were nothing but a cadre of articulate sophists. If that's not bulletin board material, I don't know what is.
You know, John, I liked it better when we had old Dominican guys on the staff.
Don't kid yourself, Barry. It's all smiles and thank you with those guys when you're winning. But the minute the team starts to look second division, it's all una acumulación inmensa de espectáculos, day in and day out.
I guess so.
College boys, Barry. What are you gonna do? Welcome once again to another installment of Celebrities Are Abettors. I'm continuing to get questions from you people as to whether I'm being ironic when I say that celebrities are abettors. No, I'm not being ironic. Why would you even think a thing like that? Celebrities are better people than us, and that's why we talk about them more. I don't understand what's so hard to understand about that. In fact, as we go through this week's celebrity news, and it's some good stuff, believe you me, ask yourself this question. If the exact same thing had happened to a friend of mine, or, you know, my uncle or cousin, would I care? I think that pretty much explains the whole point of this segment. So to begin with, we're going to hop on over to OK Magazine, yet another article from my very favorite celebrity magazine, OK, which is written for 6-year-olds. The headline pretty much says it all. Kim Kardashian finally puts love first. Thank God. I don't know how long I've been waiting for Kim Kardashian to finally put love first. Fans are watching as Kim Kardashian takes New York by storm on her reality show Kourtney and Kim Take New York. By storm, presumably. But now, Kim might make NYC her permanent home to be with her New Jersey-based boyfriend, Chris Humphries. His name is also spelled with a K, so he fits right in. As their relationship heats up, OK's got all the details in this week's all-new issue. Kim and Chris hate doing long distance, and she loves New York, a source tells OK of the star, who lives in L.A., and her love, who plays basketball for the New Jersey Nets. It makes sense for them to plan a home together. Just like real people, you know? In fact, Kim's been spotted looking for apartments for them in the artsy Chelsea neighborhood in Manhattan, right across the river from Hoboken, New Jersey, where Chris currently lives, and where he and Kim have been spotted dining and shopping. I don't, frankly, know why she just doesn't move to Jersey, because, I mean, if there's any zip code more trendy than Chelsea, it's got to be Hoboken, New Jersey. Chris makes her laugh, gives her confidence, and she feels really loved, says a pal. If there's one thing Kim Kardashian needs, it's confidence. She doesn't want to have any regrets in this relationship. After all, workaholic Kim has made mistakes in the past. Her relationship with Reggie Bush fizzled as time together often took a backseat to her budding career. It might possibly have something to do with the distance between Reggie Bush and Chris Humphries' athletic abilities, but probably not. But now, Kim is on top of her game. She was the highest-paid reality star in 2010, thanks to her TV show and endorsement deals with the likes of Skechers and Quick Trim, plus her clothing and jewelry lines, perfume, and even a New York Times bestseller. So let's review this. Her last relationship fell apart because she was a workaholic and she spent too much time on her career. But this time, since she's now the highest paid reality star, and she has a TV show and endorsement deals, a clothing and jewelry line, perfume, and a New York Times bestseller, she's, I guess, going to work less hard because, alright. And Kim can do a lot of her work in New York, adds an insider, so it seems the time is finally right for her to make love a priority. There are three sources cited in this article. It's a huge commitment, but Kim feels Chris is worth it. She thinks he's someone special, says a friend. As for Chris, he's also excited, says the source. He's smitten. Kim's everything he hoped and more. He wants to see where this goes, says the insider. Well, it's not going to Hoboken, Chris. Let's move along to E! Magazine, article from Ted Casablanca's The Awful Truth. This article is actually written by, allegedly, by Ted and Taryn Ryder, who spells her name with two Y's. I guess it took two people to write this article because it's so extra bitchy. Did Robert Pattinson and Kristen Stewart adopt a puppy together? Wow, I can't wait to find out, can you? Nothing says true love like puppy love. And so it seems that Robert Pattinson and Kristen Stewart have made a very big step. It was rumored that R. Pats had adopted a dog a few weeks ago. That was a rumor that happened, that he had adopted a dog. And now his ex-whatever, Nikki Reed, just let it slip that it might not only be Rob's pup. How did you know that? Nikki quipped to Hollywood Life when they asked about Rob's new furry friend. It's just so weird to me that when you get a dog, like 78 hours ago, the whole world knows about it. Let's review that statement. It's just so weird to me that when you get a dog, like 78 hours ago, the whole world knows about it. So apparently the whole world knew about it 3 days before he actually got it. That's some good gossip reporting, Ted Casablanca. So did Ms. Reed, looking cute in a romper... That's an adult. They're talking about... Let it slip that it is Rob and Kristen's dog. She continued, I didn't even know they got a dog, and I brought my dog, and people were saying that mine was a bigger version. That's what she said. It's Rob's dog. It just becomes a community dog on set. See, this is what happens when you elect a Democrat. When Rob and Kristen were in L.A. over Oscar weekend, they were spotted at a vet in the valley a few blocks down from where they were later seen, shopping for some vintage clothes. Kristen, being the good GF she obviously is, would have accompanied Rob anyway, but we just assumed at the time the dog belonged to both of them. They're shacking up in Vancouver together, for freak's sake. Don't you all just love this? Because we do. What choice do I have, Ted Casablanca? Moving on to, this is a great story by Rennie Dibal out of the pages of People magazine. Jewel, my Cadillac saved my life. Remember Jewel, the large-breasted Alaskan who wrote really well-meaning folk songs in the 1990s? She's still alive, and that's largely because of her Cadillac SUV. Jewel is recovering well this weekend from an accident that could have been much worse for her and her unborn baby. On Friday, the pregnant singer, 36, was hit by a fire truck in Texas. I don't know why I find that so funny, but I do. It's something about getting hit by a fire truck that's inherently comical. But doctors said both she and the baby would be fine. On Saturday, the singer said that she had her car to thank for that. One thing I do know is my car saved my and my baby's life, Jewel tweeted. Definitely going to get another Cadillac SRX. It absorbed all the damage and kept me safe. Might have been a different outcome had she hit someone with her car, but luckily for all of us, that didn't happen. Now she's enjoying some R&R on doctor's orders. Doctor said no working out, she wrote. So I'm just going to take it easy this weekend. Just a little sore and banged up, but feeling so blessed this morning. Here's my favorite part of the article, because I just want to remind you folks, these are professional journalists, hurts to say that, who write these pieces. In January, Jewel told people that she and her husband, Ty Murray, parenthesis, who tried to get pregnant for 2 years, end parenthesis, are having a boy. Now I'm going to read that again so you realize that the awkward sentence construction makes it sound like her husband, Ty Murray, tried to get pregnant for 2 years. In January, Jewel told people that she and husband Ty Murray, who tried to get pregnant for 2 years, are having a boy. It's the parenthesis that does it, folks. You know, you just... there's all sorts of books you can... Let's move on. The headline of this week was the terrible, terrible tsunami and earthquake that hit the entire Pacific Rim, most especially Japan, and there's nothing funny about it. Well, maybe there's something funny about it, but, you know, leave it to the National Enquirer to turn it into something that just makes you want to not live anymore. Japan quake, celeb evac terror, reports the Enquirer. Celebs evacuated from tsunami path in the aftermath of Japan terror quake that's killed hundreds of thousands in untold devastation. Hasn't killed hundreds of thousands, so far as we know yet, but, you know, that shouldn't stop the Enquirer from continuing to write without proper sentence constructions. Unleashed by Japan's biggest recorded earthquake, a ferocious tsunami slammed into its eastern coast Friday, killing hundreds of people. Well, it's down from hundreds of thousands in the first paragraph. As it carried away ships, cars, and homes, and triggered widespread fires that burned out of control. Hours later, the waves washed ashore in Hawaii and the U.S. West Coast, where evacuations, including the cast of Hawaii Five-0, Twilight Breaking Dawn, and funny man Jimmy Kimmel, were ordered to higher ground as per civil defense orders. In northeastern Japan, the area around a nuclear power plant was evacuated after the reactor's cooling system failed and pressure began building inside. That's almost journalism right there. It doesn't involve celebrities at all. Come on, Inquirer. What's going on the stick? Police said 200 to 300 bodies were found in the northeastern coastal city of Sendai, the city in Miyagi Prefecture, close to the quake epicenter, 8.9 magnitude, the highest ever recorded in modern history, that triggered a 23-foot tsunami, is being followed, yeah, that's right, folks, being followed by multiple aftershocks, more than 50, many of them more than magnitude 6.0. The punctuation in that sentence is glorious. I'm just going to have to refer you to the print article. Now we get to the meat of the article. Thanks for wasting all our time with those paragraphs not involving celebrities, Inquirer. Twilight Breaking Dawn star Tinsel Corey. Yes, that's right. Tinsel is this person's first name, and Corey is their last name. Corey with a K. Age 30, who plays Maka Emily Young. Is that a thing? I don't... dramatically tweeted... How do you dramatically tweet out of Vancouver? They're evacuating us for... That's a number. A tsunami sick warning. If this dot 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 is my last my tweet... Yes, I know. I love you. The end. Hugs with a Z. You can't describe something as dramatic that ends with the word hugs with a Z. That's got to be a violation of some law. Meanwhile, Hawaii Five-O star Daniel Dai Kim tweeted, "Thank you for all your thoughts and prayers. My family and I have moved to high ground. Now we wait, dot, dot, dot." He later added, "Back at work, bleary-eyed and heartsick, but very grateful. As far as I know, everyone is safe." Well, everyone who's famous... THX, number two, all of you, number four, your kind thoughts, truly. What, no hugs with a Z, Daniel Dai Kim? Lousy 140 character limit. Reports of a major superstar relief effort are underway. Well, I think that says it all. Once the superstars start undertaking a relief effort, then we don't even really need to worry about the story anymore. So, thanks for tuning in, and we'll have... more celebrities are betters as soon as we have word that funny man Jimmy Kimmel is all right. Dearest Alfred, greetings from sunny Ibiza. The weather is delightful as always. The people are friendly. The champagne cold and crisp. And the nightclubs filled with beautiful girls. Of course, it's hard to appreciate any of those things when both your legs and three of your ribs are broken, but... that's the price one pays for spending one's evenings engaged in rooftop fisticuffs with a demented crocodile man instead of going to charity banquets. Which brings me to the point of this letter. You have always served me well, Alfred, as you served my father before me. If it had not been for your strength, your pity, and your love, it seems unlikely that I would have survived the heartbreak of my parents' death. You took a hysterical, shattered 9-year-old boy who had all the sense of his world broken to bits by a pair of bullets, and you molded him into a man. For this, I will be eternally grateful. But your commitment to my service did not end there. When I had achieved my manhood and took it upon myself to exact revenge on all the criminals of the world for the evil done by one of their number, it is to your credit that you didn't point out the insanity of such a quest. Some people might harbor recriminations. Some might call you a facilitator, an enabler. Not me, Alfred. Neither you nor my father raised me to be an ingrate. It would say little about your abilities if I were to hold a grudge against you for letting me get so deep into this deranged obsession of mine. After all, what could you have done to stop me? I was a man possessed. Certainly you tried to make my madness evident to me. Your endless sarcastic comments used to annoy me. But with the clarity brought about by time and distance, I realized you were truly trying to help me. I remember as far back as when I was first trying to think of a way to strike fear and awe into the hearts of Gotham's criminals, and you suggested buying them a one-way ticket to Metropolis. Back then, I thought it was some kind of a slight against me. Later on, of course, after I spent 6 weeks in intensive care from fighting Clayface, only to have Superman knock him into a coma with one punch, did I realize how right you had been. And when that bat flew through the window of the reading room and I announced that I'd found my symbol, you told me that I should count myself lucky that I wouldn't be appearing as Finchman, or the Mosquito, or Dark Pigeon. What's truly lucky is that I had someone like you to tell me what a fool I was. Not that I ever listened. I was, as I say, a man possessed. You were my closest contact with reality, and such was my purpose that I ignored you completely. Fortunately for all of us, there were plenty more harsh lessons to come. The 92% release rate of criminals that I captured was harsh dose number one. I had spent far too much time studying martial arts, chemistry, and forensics, and not nearly enough studying basic legal principles, such as the one that says if you're the only witness to a crime, and you capture the criminal yourself and leave him tied up in front of the police station without even a note, even if charges are brought and you refuse to give the cops your real name, let alone appear at the trial and give evidence, what's going to happen is that they let him go and probably apologize while they're at it. Harsh dose number two is that while criminals are indeed a superstitious and cowardly lot, they are also a surprisingly litigious one. In my first 2 years alone in the Tights and Cowl, I was named in over 300 lawsuits. The money I spent building the Batcave didn't make a dent in the Wayne fortune, but nearly 100 out-of-court settlements almost wiped it out. Harsh dose number three, as you're well aware, has to do with the fact that the Joker isn't the Joker because he didn't want to get a 9-to-5 job, but rather because he's a fucking lunatic who had gassed to death an entire busload of children just to distract me long enough to hit me in the head with a plastic hammer that honks. Dealing with people like that didn't so much satisfy my sense of justice, so much as it made me wish I'd gone into public relations. And that's why I'm writing you this letter, dear Alfred. After 29 months as the protector of Gotham City, I've realized a few things. I've realized that it was a shame about my father dying and all, but my trying to avenge his death by wailing on every petty criminal in the city is, well, insane and suicidal. And after all, what does it mean in the end other than I got my inheritance a little early? I've realized that fighting crazy people who can disintegrate solid objects with a touch is all well and good for Wonder Woman, but it's maybe not so good for me. I can't even ski, Alfred. How many more guys with spandex briefs are going to put me in traction before I start enjoying myself? And finally, I've realized that when I die, the choice is mine how I want to be remembered. As a billionaire playboy who pretended to enjoy life while he pounced around every night getting his face beaten in by Two-Face, or as a billionaire playboy who actually enjoyed life. As you can see from the postmark on this letter, I've made my choice. Please see about giving the Batmobile a paint job and seeing if Oliver will take it off my hands. Give Jim Gordon my best and tell him good luck in finding a replacement. I'm sure that even Man-Bat would do a better job than I ever did. And please tell Dick that we'll sort out his severance package when I return. Love, Bruce. That bat signals the end of another dynamic episode of the Petardcast, a failed experiment in the creative limitations of high technology. Thanks are due to my special guest, Scott Vondoviak, whose work can be found in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the Onion's AV Club, and his blog, vondoviak.wordpress.com. Thanks, too, to Hayden Childs for the exciting GBV remix of our theme song. Join me once more in 2 weeks for episode 13 of the Petardcast, the unluckiest podcast of them all. Guests@ludiclive.com is the address to write if you're interested in appearing as a guest, and info@ludiclive.com is the destination for hate mail and gloating. You may subscribe to this frustrating program on the iTunes Music Store, or listen anytime via ludiclive.com. That's ludiclive.com for the hearing impaired. I'd like to desiccate this episode to Bob Kane and Cameron Von Clear, prisoner number 234026. And the most thanks of all are due to you, the listener, for allowing this unconscionable minor league silliness into your airspace. Signing off from the place where you keep all the crimes you've thought about committing, my name is Leonard Pierce, and this is your Petardcast.